I think we can move to the next part of the agenda, which is the implementation issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie. Katrina?
Yes. Good morning, everyone. It's Agenda Papers 12 on interpretation activities. First of all, I'll just briefly mention Agenda Paper 12, which is an update on the Interpretations Committee meeting in July, and then I'll hand over to Takashi to talk about Agenda Paper 12A. So as I say, Agenda Paper 12 includes the IFRIC update reflecting the Interpretations Committee discussions in July. We have already actually had a September Interpretations Committee meeting. However, because update was only finalised on that late on Friday, what we plan to do is come back to you in October and provide you with the update on the September meeting. So with that, in Agenda Paper 12, I was just going to highlight three things that were the main part of the discussions. The first is that the Interpretation Committee completed its discussions around the IS 21 interpretation. So that now that's actually at the point of going through the balloting process, and we expect to bring that to you for ratification in October. The second is that the Interpretation Committee issued a tentative agenda decision on IS 12, and that's addressing a specific question about how you determine what is the expected manner of recovery of an indefinite lived intangible asset. And that's set out an update. And finally, the Interpretation Committee finalised two agenda decisions. The first of those related to what we call the loss of control transactions. So transactions where an entity loses control but retains either joint control of an operation or still is a party to a joint operation. This issue on discussion we realised was the sort of issue that we were dealing with was very similar to the issue that was dealt with in the amendment to IS 28 that the board has decided to defer. So with that in mind, the Interpretation Committee recommended that it would make sense to look at this transaction at the same time as the board re-looks at that issue on the sale or contribution of assets to an associate or a joint venture. And the committee noted in giving that recommendation that they thought the PIRs of IFRS 10 and 11 would provide a good opportunity to consider those issues. And the second agenda decision was on IFRIC 12, service concession arrangements, and it specifically dealt with accounting for payments made by an operator in a service concession arrangement. So with that, I don't know if you have any comments or thoughts on the July meeting.
Good morning, everybody. So Agenda Paper 12A discusses the accounting for long-term interest in associates and joint venture that in substance form part of the net investment, those interests that we describe as long-term interests. The board discussed this issue earlier this year, and after that discussion, the Interpretations Committee continued its discussion, and in May, it tentatively decided to develop a draft interpretation in response to noted diversity in practice. At the committee meeting 2 weeks ago, the Interpretations Committee completed its discussion and directed the staff to prepare the ballot draft, subject to no significant matters arising from today's discussion. A summary of the technical matters reached by the Interpretations Committee is included in paragraphs 12 to 31 of the paper. The main consensus reached is described in paragraph 15, in which it explains that long-term interest is subject to both IFRS 9 and IS 28 requirements. And this is because the scope exception in paragraph 2.11a of IFRS 9 does not apply to long-term interest, and those interests are still subject to some of the IS 28 requirements. Please note that this conclusion is consistent with the conclusion reached by the board earlier this year. Other than this consensus, the Interpretations Committee discussed presentation and disclosure, and an illustrative example, and transition requirements, and the proposed effective date. And these are summarized in paragraphs 16 to 31 of the paper. And Appendix B sets out the example the committee discussed, and Appendix C summarizes the proposals, the committee's proposals relating to transition. Before we move on to the due process aspects and a question on page 12, I'd like to ask you whether you have any questions on the technical matters discussed by the Interpretations Committee.
Doc?
Yes. Can I ask a simple question about your example? On page 16, you gave us a table. And let me talk about the end of period 3. So if you look at the page 16, the end of the period 3, the cumulative loss of associates is 650. And so 40% share of 650, which belongs to the parent, is only 260. However, if you look at the page 20 and the last table, the end of the period 3, the net investment balance is only 40. So that means the cumulative loss, which to be recognized is 360. So there is a gap between 260 and 360. And I think it is the overlap of a dual application of two standards. One is IFRS 9 and one is IS 28. Is my understanding correct? Is it overlap?
Well, the Interpretations Committee concluded that there's no double counting of losses because it observed that it's just two different impairment assessments applied to two different units of account for different accounting purposes. And the Interpretations Committee, even though it acknowledged that in certain situations, the accounting number produced as a result of application of these proposals would produce a number that may not be particularly useful. The Interpretations Committee thought that disclosure should explain what is happening with the accounting amount of long-term interest so that the readers of the financial statements can understand.
But actually we are applying two standards for one single asset. And the IS 28 and the IFRS 9 has completely different concept. IS 28 is talking about the evaluation or look at the performance of the business which is going concern. And IS 9 is to look at what the collection of the money. So it's okay to apply it, but if there is an overlap, we should eliminate it. Without eliminating it, it could be overkilling. Say, for example, what if we have 400 investment which do not contain equity investment? It's all loans or preference share. In that case, what kind of amount we have to recognize as an impairment? I think it's only 200 because when the amount is 200, it recognizes 100 losses impairment. So if you double that investment, so based on the IFRS 9, the impairment amount is only 200. And based on the IS 28, the amount you have to recognize is only 260. But if you mix up those two and the false dual application, it ends up to false recognition of 360. It's nothing but overkilling, I think, isn't it?
Well, I think I mean, I think your point, TAC, is one of the things that got discussed quite a lot, actually, at the various meetings, both when we talked to you and through various interpretations committee meetings. And I think, as Takashi said, it's a concept that including long-term interests and sort of in the requirements of IS 28, and so for loss allocation and for impairment, was something that the board back in 2003 deliberately did, in a sense, which creates the situation now where you've got that. I think you described it, there's two different things going on with this particular instrument. They have got two different objectives, though, so which is why I think we conclude we don't think it's double counting of losses. So in applying IFRS 9, you're looking at, for that particular long-term interest, what do I think the cash flows are I'm going to receive on it, and potentially impairing it if necessary. And when you come into IAS 28, particularly for loss allocation, that's not actually about directly about looking out at the cash flows I'll receive. That's about simply saying the mechanics of the equity method are such that I think I want to pick up, you know, the losses of the associate that I have the special relationship with.
I don't think it's kind of two different things. Simply happening. Mechanics. I think there is a concept. The concept is those investment loans and preference share is all part of the net investment. And actually, in my experience, most of the cases when we use this type of investment is the case if you have an investment in developing country in the key industry like mining or automotive industry. In that case, normally the country restricts the limitation of the investment, equity investment. Therefore, in that case, they would limit the equity investment, but instead they increase preference share or loans. However, it is a part of the net investment. So therefore, the loss allocation is not the simply mechanics of equity accounting, but there is a concept that it's a part of the net investment. So therefore, you have to recognize losses.
But I think, are you saying then, TAC, for those things that you consider to be part of the net investment, that you would apply all of the equity method to it? You would consider to be part of the investment to which you apply the equity?
The best solution is to apply all equity investment, but still, because it is not equity investment, so then current solution is the best solution. But we should avoid overlapping application of IFRS 9 in specific cases, because if we apply it overlapping, as I said, it could be overkilling. And this is a matter of scope issue, not the issue of procedure. So the question is, what is the scope of loss allocation of net investment? So if we could provide a good interpretation about what is the scope of loss allocation, if we could provide a limited case, like I explained, then it would be limited. And other than that, should be applied to IFRS 9. So such kind of solution is much better.
Beryl?
So I think Tuck raises one of my concerns with what we've got in front of us in its entirety. The question that we were asked was a relatively narrow one, which is how does the impairment test in IFRS 9 interact with the impairment test in IAS 28? And if you go through the same journals that Tuck has worked through, you can see that there is possibly a double process in terms of actually doing the one test and then the other test, but there is no double counting implication of that. The interpretation seems to have taken a much wider scope than just the question that was asked and seems to go much broader into the whole mechanics, the whole process of equity accounting, and brings out other things which I don't think were part of the original question, and brings into question, I think, the whole concept of how you apply equity accounting, how you think about equity accounting. Now, my concern with that is that it's broader than what was requested. It's likely to bring up or highlight or bring to question a lot of other issues around equity accounting, which is something we're considering in a separate space. And I'm just concerned that what we're doing is we're creating a diversion that's not necessarily going to help us solve the original problem, which to my mind was a simple one. So I'm not clear now whether what we should be doing is trying to narrow down the interpretation process, or, to be honest, having in the past decided that there were other solutions that we shouldn't consider because this seemed the easier one. I'm now starting to think the other ones may actually be more desirable than what the outcome is here. And I think it's just because the scope is now broadened to a lot of other things that were not part of the original.
So, I was going to say something very similar to Daryl. I'm very worried about this interpretation, and I've said it twice to the Interpretations Committee, so if they're listening, they're not going to be surprised. And I'm really worried because of a couple of things. Firstly, the question we got initially was a very narrow question from my recollection, which was, are long-term investments really in the scope of 9 and the scope of 28? And the staff took us and the Interpretations Committee down a very long and tortuous path, which was just about impossible to get us to focus on the question we were being asked. In the end, you succeeded to say, and the board, from memory, said, yes, it's clear how the scope works. There was then questions about whether we liked the answer, but the staff managed to get us to focus and say, yes, it's clear. My recollection is the Interpretations Committee also decided it's clear. And I don't really understand how we get from a position where we say it's clear, the Interpretations Committee says it's clear, and we end up deciding we need to issue a great long interpretation to interpret that it's clear. And my concern with that is twofold. Firstly, I'm not sure if we should be publishing interpretations where two groups have both decided it was clear. But also, every discussion that we have on this, whether it's at the board table or whether it's at the Interpretations Committee, we can't resist immediately talking about all of these knock-on mechanics of equity accounting. And so given that, I can only imagine that if we issue an interpretation, we're going to get a whole load of letters back talking about whether or not people agree with the mechanics of equity accounting. And getting people to focus on the original question that people needed answering, I think, is going to be well nigh impossible. And if we've done it in the context of a broader interpretation, I think the real challenge for me is we were asked to answer a particular question that people had on application. If we're not careful, and this gets caught up in a debate on equity accounting, not only are we not going to answer that question, we've probably got a whole group of people who used to think it was clear what the interpretation was, who are now thinking, geez, if they're issuing this great long interpretation, maybe it wasn't clear in the first place. So I'm worried we're going to increase diversity in practice, which is the opposite of our objective, and it's going to be prolonged because of the nature of the interpretation we've issued. So what am I missing that we've got from a clear answer to this long interpretation?
Yeah, so I'll try to, because I've asked myself the same question a number of times. So if I walk through the steps, I suppose, I think it's right to say, look, every single discussion we've had is at the board, at the Interpretation Committee, and in any other, you know, outreach meetings or otherwise we had, I think we all, me included, initially certainly find it difficult to focus on what we think the requirements say versus, you know, what we think about the outcome, having walked through it. And I think even when people think about it in the context of IFRS 9 even versus IAS 39, it becomes a bit more difficult, because I think when people think, okay, if I've already applied IFRS 9 to these long-term interests, then I'm already measuring this at either fair value or at amortized cost, having applied, you know, an expected credit loss model. So then when I come along and potentially write that carrying amount down to a lower amount, that just seems like, well, why am I doing that? And I think a lot of the discomfort comes from those requirements in IAS 28 that says you potentially write it down lower loss allocation and possible impairment. So I think because of that, it took several meetings to sort of get to the point, you know, where we were able to walk through, look at the requirements and say, what do we think the requirements say? And look at that in isolation of saying whether there's, you know, something that we think maybe could be changed at some point. And so I think one thing that drove the Interpretations Committee to think that they needed to do an interpretation was because they said, well, it took us several meetings to kind of piece together the requirements, so somehow I think an agenda decision isn't quite enough to add the clarity. I think also, if you highlighted in terms of the size of the interpretation, I think that probably because of the discomfort that some of the mechanics around the IAS 28 requirements, there were a lot of questions came up about, well, what if this happens, and what if this happens, how do the debits and credits work? So I just think over the course of the discussions, the what started out as a smaller example has ended up being expanded to cover more what-if scenarios that probably do end up by talking more about how to apply the equity method in a sense and the mechanics of that to these transactions.
I wonder whether we need
to... I was going to say, Sue, are you saying you really prefer to focus on the core question about the application of IFRS 9?
I just worry about wasting a lot of people's time.
Yeah, because effectively we'll get a lot of commentary about the application of the equity method, which we're going to be looking at some point in the future anyway.
Mary?
I can understand Sue's concerns. I think I'd hesitate to pull the plug on this interpretation at this point in time, partly, Petrina, for the reason you cited about once you have worked through it, I think we conclude that all of the interactions point to a single answer without any interpretation as such, but that it did throw up a lot of mechanical issues. And I think I'd instead go back and communicate. I would hesitate also if our interpretation committee, which we've set up, a lot of very experienced people contribute their time and thought to it. I think I wouldn't block it at this point in time, but I think the message to carry back from the board may be, and also to include in a document that gets issued, this is, well, it's expanded, it's about answering the question of the interaction of the two standards. It's not intended to be extensive guidance on the application of the equity method. And if the feedback from the exposure of the interpretation points to a request for answering more interpretation, you know, more guidance on equity method, which, as Henry just said, we have, I think, bit put on our research pipeline, I think is the place it sits now. We're not, that's not going to happen in either an interpretation or an amendment. And the alternative would be to pursue potentially an AIP or something like that that just looked at, confirming the applicability of both the FI impairment and the loss absorption under 28. And that, to Sue's point, how big a process does it have to be? I think that was an alternative, but I don't think I'd override the interpretation committee's collective judgment at this point, but maybe warning for future to not get caught in the trap again, and kind of send a signal that if this kind of mushrooms into a how do you apply the equity method project, say, our view is it shouldn't go forward as that and look for other ways to provide the simple clarification to the question, the basic question that was answered. But I would not object to issuing this.
My challenge with that is that's what we did on NCI puts.
So the outcome of an interpretation can be that the existing texts are clear.
No, that would be an agenda decision.
But yes, but the outcome is that it is clear, right?
That there's only one way to read the standard. Yes. There are the interactions. But as Petrina said, it took, I think, three meetings and three lots of staff papers for people to reach the conclusion that that's the only way to read it.
Thank you. I agree with Sue's point. The reason why I'm saying is this is two issues intermingled. The current existing standard is quite clear. We should do two steps of impairment test for different unit of accounts. So it's quite clear. However, the current requirement might not be satisfactory. So there is some group who would like to amend current existing standards requirements. That's a different issue. Mm-hmm. So as Mary said, if you'd like to amend that kind of the twice impairment test on this special instrument, then we should include that idea into the next future project. The another thing is this is quite rare case, as Takashi explained in the illustration example, because so rare, so we didn't include any illustration in this example. So what I'm saying is that the consequences of their, even though we do not issue interpretation, there's no big impact. Based on the agenda papers for the interpretation committee, by Takashi, it was very excellent. They were really well analyzed, well written. So there's no confusion to the markets. Everybody can do apply this to impairment test. So I don't want to issue the interpretation committee a proposal as an interpretation.
Stephen.
I agree with Sue and Darrell's concerns. It seems to me that the confirmation that IFRS 9 applies to the long-term interest measured at amortized cost, which is the narrow question that was asked, could be given in a much more efficient way than this interpretation, so an agenda decision and annual improvement. What we're doing with this is combining that with a whole lot of education on the equity method. And I'm not sure that an interpretation is the best way of giving people education. We have other mechanisms for doing that. And then we're combining this whole thing with a problem that people have always known about, this loss allocation, and we're muddying the waters with this sort of potential future standard setting, which is in the wider project of perhaps modifying equity accounting to resolve the problem that's been well identified and is not a new problem because it already exists. So I agree with Sue.
Can I just add on, because I don't want to give the impression that I'm dismissing the advice of our committee, because obviously they are an important committee and they don't take their decisions lightly either. So I don't think we should throw out what they've said or ignore what they said. What I'm really asking is there a more efficient way that perhaps we could deliver it? So, for example, is there a more efficient way to deal with the scope question, for example, through an annual improvement? Is there a more efficient way to deliver the education material that people want, the example people want to understand the mechanics, for example, through education material, rather than saying, we disagree with you, therefore we're just not going to do it? But I guess that would be maybe something the staff could think about. So I'm not saying do nothing with it. I'm just questioning whether it's going to be the most efficient use of our resources and our stakeholders' resources of issuing it in this current form.
Gary.
All things considered, I actually like where the Interpretations Committee came out, and whether or not the T accounts and the journal entries should be in education or attached to it, I think we can work that, but I still found them quite useful. It actually, quite frankly, I wish we had more of those in our work product, whether the standard education material or someplace else. But to say that we two different groups got there, this is clearly the right answer. It was an extremely torturous path over a couple of years by a lot of smart accountants to say, it's very clear, well, if that was the path it took this group to get there, no one else is going to get there. And I think any time you've got a transaction or a balance that has two standards that intersect it, IFRS 9 new and IAS 28 or others are being around for decades, it's always a problem. I think this is sort of saying this is the order to apply the different standards. I mean, to make it simple, you'd either said IAS 28 doesn't apply to long-term interest or IFRS 9 doesn't apply. That's the only way to have made it simple. When you said both apply, then you get to the order of operations of how to apply them. So I think we actually have roughly right the final product. Again, the T accounts and the flow charts or flow tables. Again, I'm somewhat indifferent if they're in standard or in education material or else someplace else, but they're actually very useful. And if you think through with this subject, actually, I think came up on the Equity Accounting Board Advisors project too, at least tangentially. And much of the problem with the equity method is the mechanics. And this helps answer that, especially if you have two competing standards in the same spot that individually would give you different answers. It's a good end product here.
So from the beginning, I support your first comment you raised two times. But then you said, you suggest use other ways, you know, agenda decision or annual improvement for any other education material. My question to you is, you know, in your mind, whether change of format will, you know, reduce your concern or eliminate your concern?
As I said, I don't want to make it up on the fly, so if we were to take a different path to the interpretation, I think it would be good to analyse what the alternatives were. But my thinking was that if we did it in a different form, maybe we could separate more the scope question from the mechanics, because I think the interpretation is putting them all in one big bundle. So people that are responding to the interpretation are not only going to come back on, did they get there on the scope, or is it clear, or is more work needed, they're going to come back and say, and by the way, this is a dreadful outcome because of the interaction between the two standards. If we were to go with a route that was more, this is the scope, and separately deal with the mechanics, maybe it would be easier to differentiate the two discussions. Maybe I'm naive. But that was
so, I'm not challenging you, but it seems you want to solve also the first concern. So changing the format.
Well, I'm suggesting this because, you know, to be respectful not only to the committee but also the views of other board members, it wasn't easy for some to get to where we got to in terms of concluding, yes, that's what the words mean. And if that is the case, then maybe we need to do more than just an agenda decision. Maybe it is a tweak to words in the standard or whatever to make sure it's crystal clear to people. So I don't want to say, you know, it's clear to me, therefore nothing should be done. I'm trying to be respectful of the feedback that we've got. I'm just trying to think of what's more efficient. And I refer to NCI puts partly jokingly, but not entirely jokingly, because in the NCI puts interpretation, the committee, and with the backing of the board, went out and said, this is clearly how you account for an NCI put, and the whole world said, we don't care if it's clear, that's stupid. And then we all went, and since then we've never managed to clarify, and that's been open for 8 years or something. And I would hate to see a repeat of that if we can avoid it.
Thank you. I think I agree that agenda decision is not enough. I think we've got to do something. And I agree to issue the interpretation, but not in this way. Because if we provide such a table, it doesn't provide any answers. And actually, this is a scope issue, as Sue mentioned. So if we were to issue an interpretation, then we can provide some interpretation about scope. And I think loss allocation itself is a very limited case, as Changgu said. However, for those companies who have this kind of situation, the amount is quite significant. And that sometimes those kind of investment is huge investment. So it's just the tip of iceberg, because IFRS 9 and IAS 28 has a lot of overlap issue. So therefore, what we could do in the interpretation is we have to limit the area of IAS 28 so that IFRS 9 can be applied in general. So then that is the most efficient way.
Are you interpreting or changing?
Not changing, just simply interpreting. Because if you look at the IAS 28, paragraph 38, it's a quite limited case. You are not collecting, you are not expecting collection. So it's almost same as equity investment. And if you look at IAS 21, paragraph 15, it says it's a part of the net investment. Therefore, the exchange loss should be recognized, OCI. So intention is, in a sense, clear that this is the part of the net investment. But part of the net investment, it's not generally interpreted. It should not be generally interpreted. This kind of situation is quite limited, like I explained. So if we could provide such a guidance, this is quite limited case, then we can sort out lots of overlap of IFRS 9 and IS 28 issue.
Martin.
And I agree also with what Sue has said, because when we discussed it already, when I said several times, it's the right interpretation or the right outcome, but I think the outcome is not what people like, and I think it's not what, if we have two impairment tests for one of the same assets and the loss allocation, that is really the issue. It is not that, and people, that is a reason why people have asked that, because they don't like the outcome. And If you now have an interpretation and have all the discussion with the outcome which nobody likes, this is not a good way to solve that issue. And therefore, I always said when we discussed it, we have to go further. But I also understand if we go further, then we now go deeply into the equity accounting, and then it is a topic for the broader project. And that's the reason why I think Sue is right in saying, okay, not make a big fuss out of it now with interpretation, if it is clear, but really what the issue is that people don't like the outcome. And now to have again the discussion about people don't like the outcome, I don't know if the interpretation is then the right way to have that discussion again.
Okay, yeah?
Well, I was just going to say, so from the discussion, if I hear a lot, there's clearly a lot of concern, if I understand, about, at least from some board members, around how wide the interpretation or the draft interpretation is potentially going in terms of, you know, showing all the mechanics are going as far as that. And so, I mean, would you want us, for example, to kind of hone down and focus more on the question asked, on the scope question, and bring something back to you that would, well, at least explores options, that if we wanted to focus on that, what we think might be the different routes or the most efficient way we could go about clarifying that piece? For example, exploring annual improvement or something else?
Because we could try to do that in October board meeting.
Yeah, we could try to do that in October.
And then that would be
and then
in advance feedback. Of the next Interpretations Committee meeting as well.
Actually, I think we should go with
bring it back
the interpretation.
To us in October, and then to the Interpretations Committee in November.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Actually,
we shouldn't do anything on the fly, but it seems...
We should put it out for comment. I think a lot of... this has been touched a lot for 2+ years, and this is where we came out. And again, we can ask the question if you want all the debits and credits part of it or outside of it, but I would publish it as, I mean, at some point, the ball's got to move forward, and I think...
Well, why don't we first vote on the question as being asked, and then take it from there. So, who supports the
negative?
Oh, yes.
Who would object?
Does any board member who intends to object to this proposal?
Who intends to object?
Yes.
Yes.
As proposed.
Okay, so then the next question is, would we like to the staff to...
Well, would you like basically the staff to come back, I think, in October,
yeah.
As Petrina said, or try in October, and effectively explore ways that we could focus on the core of the question and what are the possible options.
Yes.
I think that's what we'd be seeking to try and do.
Yes.
And I think there are a few suggested ways we might do that.
Yes.
Do you agree with that part?
Trying to take account of the feedback we've got from the Interpretation Committee members on the areas of concern.
Okay. Can I just ask a related question? What's the status of the longer-term project on equity accounting?
Pipeline.
So it's in the pipeline, I think, with the idea that the last piece of input, obviously there's been quite a bit of work, but I think the last piece of input into that might come out of some of the initial work on the PIR around 10, 11 and 12. Is that correct, Peter?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the last piece of input, I think,
okay,
before
sorry.
We do anything further.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. It's just that this has highlighted a particular problem, the loss allocation, and I'm just wondering how many years it might be before standard setting does something about it.
The reason we're waiting for the PIR is that there's been some extension of the scope to joint ventures, and we thought it would be silly to rush forward when there might be some new source of inputs coming out of that. We're not necessarily going to wait for the end of the PIR of IFRS 11, we'll see, but when we think we've got enough information to start activating it, we'll do that.
I think we highlighted previously that the challenge of trying to make any sort of quick fix to IS 28 is very challenging. I mean,
but it does highlight that it needs work.
Yeah, it does.
But nonetheless, and there have been quite a few questions that have, you know, come around this area through the interpretation process.
Okay. having come to the end of the IFRIC discussion, I would just like to take a moment to pause with the untimely death of Wayne Upton. We have already done so in many on several occasions, but I think it's also good to do this at this official board meeting. Wayne has been with us for many years in various capacities, the technical director, chairman of the EEG, the Emerging Economies Group. He was instrumental in our working group on Islamic finance, and of course he was a very, in the last couple of years, he was a very capable chairman of IFRIC. I think we all know him as a very thoughtful man with a good sense of humor and very insightful man, and we will greatly miss him also as chairman of IFRIC. So I'd like to take just a minute of silence, please. Okay. Now.